Gear Garage Podcast. We're sitting down with industry leaders to talk shop on gear, rivers, and the boating life. Let's get into it.
Well, I hope you like that new intro. This is a show I'm trying to do where I interview people in the rescue world and have these 10 questions I want to ask. And today I have Louis Jacob Campbell, and he works in Quebec. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. But right now is in New Zealand as a river guide. And I'm going to ask him the same questions I asked Jim, and hopefully we'll ask more rescue instructors. If you're a rescue instructor out there and want to like come on and talk about this stuff, please reach out to me. I want to do more of these. I learn a lot from them, and I think everybody does too. Welcome, Louis Jacob.
Yeah, thanks, Zach.
Did I pronounce your name right?
Yeah, kind of. The accent is definitely, you need to work on it, but no, that was good, bro.
Yeah, I tried. Before we were with the show, we were talking about who you work for in Quebec. Did I pronounce Quebec right?
Yep.
It's New Wave Expeditions. You had a different name for it though. Is it the French name?
Yeah, the French name is Expedition Nouvelle Vague.
Okay, there's no way I'm pronouncing that. No. But you were saying it's a co-op and there's 28 owners. How does that work?
Yeah, so basically, if I got my numbers correct, we're 28 owners. Mm-hmm. What happened is the old owners wanted to sell. All the people from the staff kind of got around. We had four people leading the way into a like project of how does a co-op work? Can we make it work? Did 1 year of like learning / trying to transfer the business, took the lead on the project, and then 28 of us got together and decided we were going to become the new owner and create a co-op with this business. So I'm part of that, obviously.
If somebody is part of the business and they leave, they still own part of the business?
Well,
just sell it back.
You can sell back your shares. We've got some things in the contract where it might take up to 5 years for the co-op to reimburse you, because if you become a co-op member, you need to pay a fee, stuff like that. So there's a little bit of an administrative side to it, but you can leave if you want. It's definitely possible. And you, if we made some money, you will get reimbursed with your shares. You can stay in, and then at some point, if we make money, then all the owners are going to make money. But the goal is to reinvest all of the money inside the business, so we can kind of good social advantages out of it and create work for the staff.
Cool. And you teach rescue. It's the Rescue 3 curriculum, but in Canada, it's called Raven Rescue. Is that correct?
Yeah. So Raven Rescue is kind of the provider for Rescue 3 in Canada. So I just recently got onto the Rescue 3 train, and I wanted to do that just to get some of an international perspective on rescue. I reached out to the guys out west who are Raven, and they kind of got me on board and helped me through that process.
Cool. And so in the summers, you're guiding rafts, but also teaching rescue at the same time. So 1 week, a couple of days, you might teach a rescue class, and you might do raft trips, kind of go back and forth.
Yeah, exactly. So when I start my season in the spring, I teach in a adventure tourism guide program where we teach to future guides in the industry. So I start with these guys doing rafting classes and river rescue classes. And then I move on to Quebec City, where the rafting business is, and I start training some staff for the new season, running commercial trips. And in between those things, I also do whitewater rescue class.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, let's get started. I want to jump into the questions, because we had some good conversations last fall, and this is a great chance to have more of these. The first one is, I'm starting to think more about whitewater rescue being separate from swiftwater rescue, where whitewater rescue is what river guides and river runners do, and swiftwater rescue is what firefighters, first responders do. Do you have a take on that? Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, well, I feel that those two terms are a good way to describe it or to split those things. Like for me, there are some pros and not necessarily cons, but different way of operating when you're in a like swift water environment versus a whitewater environment. I'd say the river is the same. to me. But if I'm teaching more of a SRT class, then I'll have folks like firefighters, search and rescue services, sometimes policemen or policewomen. And these guys don't necessarily use the river as their hobby. You know, they don't go boating, they don't go paddling. So sometimes the river sense and the knowledge of the river is not really there. So you have to start from the beginning, where what you're going to do is a little bit more of that prevention. You're going to teach them about the risk of the river, how the flow can be super strong. So you have to really start at the beginning and then build on through that. Whereas a whitewater rescue class, the boater, the people are using the river, they already know about it. Mm-hmm. They know the power of the river, they know kind of the risk, they have a little bit of experience, or maybe they took a class because they had some bad experience on the river. What is really cool with SRT services and stuff like that is that they have heaps of resource. You know, most of the time they have money, they have lots of equipment, they have lots of people that can come on the scene. And most of the time, what I feel is they're going to get a call that something happened on the river, and then they arrive and they have to intervene on what they see. Versus when you're in a whitewater rescue class, people are going down the river and then something happened and it's kind of live. You know, it's right now. It's now or never. So time might be a little bit more sensitive. So I feel like the techniques we're teaching are pretty much the same. It's just the way you bring it and the way you're going to use that, like, simple to complex sequence when you teach is a little bit different. But mm-hmm. I like the fact that we can split them both. Yeah, definitely when I can do a only whitewater rescue class with boater, it's super nice. Like, I can really dig into it and provide what they need. And when I'm in an SRT class, and these guys are all on the same pace, same level, then we can build on from that. So I like the fact that this thing can be really split apart.
Cool. On that thing, I think these first two questions are kind of straightforward, I think, but I've been thinking a lot about people taking rescue courses, like a new, let's say a first or second year guide, and they're being taught how to use a tethered rescue and how to tie really complicated knots and systems. And I feel like I'm seeing that there should be like more introductory level courses, and then separately advanced courses for the people that want to do kind of the advanced higher end stuff. Are you guys able to teach that way? Do you think that's important? Like, yeah. Do you have any thoughts about like having like more just general safety rescue class for the general guide/boater who's new, and then something that is more advanced for, or even intermediate for, people who've been doing this for a while?
Yeah. Well, 100%. I mean, I feel like the introduction to rescue for the boaters sometimes is not necessarily into a rescue class. Like, people, there's a couple of different ways of entering the whitewater world. Some people would do it through mentoring with some friends. Some others will do it with maybe a kayak club or a rafting club. And then there's going to be some kind of an introduction class where you learn a little bit how to paddle, how to carry your boat. And sometimes you learn a little bit about swimming in the river. You learn a little bit about throw bagging, you know, so there's kind of that little bit of an introduction. And I feel that if you start that journey with a good mentor or a good safety tip, then it's a really good thing. You know, what can happen is that you learn with a friend that didn't learn necessarily through that good way, and is going to show you some stuff that might put you more in danger. You know, you're not necessarily conscious of the risk, and you can paddle for a really long time without anything bad happening to you, and it's just gonna add on, and at some point something really big will happen. So yeah, I feel like teaching the basics is a really, really good way to help people get more training, more practice. That's gonna build experience and judgment. So yeah, I like the fact that you can go with something super simple and then you add on to it and you go with a slow curve. I feel the first thing you want to learn is a little bit how the river works. What are the different features so everybody can get on the same level of when you speak, you all speak the same language. And then we're going to start with some stuff about like self-rescue. So how can I swim and how can I, me and my body be a craft in the river? And then after that, how can I help one of my teammates and not put myself necessarily into the action or in the danger? So something that we would call in English more of an, like a conditional rescue, where the person you're rescuing needs to be active and participating in the rescue. So a little bit of throwbagging. Those were the things that I would like to have in an introductionary classes. Maybe a little bit of like entrapment drills as well, because small rapids with lots of rocks, the chances of getting your foot stuck is definitely a big possibility. So I would like to have a basic introduction to those like techniques where you can get someone out of an entrapment. That would be for me like the introductionary level, you know? And then after that, if you get to the intermediate level, you're going to use those same skills, swimming, throwbagging, and build on them, become really good at it. And we're going to add a little bit more of some more complex scenario where other entrapment drills. I'll touch a little bit of the tethered rescue, but mostly how the quick release harness works and how you really want to fit your PFD. Because one of the things that I see is people are going to buy brand new gear and they're going to have that new in this jacket and they'll tight their quick release because they think that this is one of the thing that you need to tight the max so it can fit your PFD. Yeah. And it's like, this is not really what it's meant for. But so you kind of have to talk about it, you know, even in an introductionary level, just a little bit, won't necessarily spend too much time. But in that intermediate level, then you'll definitely use that, you know, because people might use the quick release harness to clip onto a boat or to a paddle. And even if I'm telling them, yeah, this might not be the number one go for you, they'll do it anyway. So I feel as a rescue instructor, I have to talk to them about it. I have to show them how to use it safely. So I'll have a little bit of that too. And one thing that is really big for us in Quebec is there's a lot of canoe expedition, you know? So unwrapping a boat is definitely something that people want to see. And for River Guide as well, like unwrapping a raft, you know, the river I work on, we have heaps of rocks and there is a couple of spots where you can wrap boats. So you'll need to learn how to unwrap them. And then if I get to a like advanced level or expert level, then we're going to take all of these skills and we're going to really get into the details of how can you do it the best possible way for every possible scenario. So there's different way of throwing a throwback. You know, you can go overhand, underhand, you can go secondary throw where you only throw coils. So all of these little variation, then we're going to spend time building on that and trying to get to the perfect level on it. And we'll start playing a little bit more with gear, nuts, maybe a little bit of like eyeline and boat on the high line in between the two riverbanks. Which is a little bit more of an SRT technique. But when I teach those classes and I get to the intermediate and to the advanced level, I always try to think about, I'm teaching you a technique and there's one main objective, but there's also heaps of secondary objective in this, where if I do a tether rescue, it's not just how you go in the river, you go get someone. It's also the person that's belaying. How can I manage the rope properly? How do I need to walk or run on the side of the river? Where will I bring the person that's on belay on the heady? You know, so there's all of these other skills that you use to build on that experience throughout the course. So, yeah, that's my take on this.
I just want to go back to you keep mentioning SRT. And that people may not know what that is. That's swift water rescue technicians. So that's like swift water rescue. And in the Rescue 3 world, and I think Raven is the same, WRT is Whitewater Rescue Technician. So
yeah.
SRT is designed for firefighters, first responders, policemen, people that come to the riverbank, lots of gear. WRT is the Whitewater Rescue Technician. So anytime you talk about SRT, it's swift water.
Yeah.
Okay. The next question, I'm kind of setting up the rest of the questions here. In a typical, let's say, like, rescue course you would teach guides, how much of that course should be preventing accidents and how much of that course should be rescue, like percentage wise or day wise? What do you think?
You mean for river guides?
For river, or, let's talk specifically river guides. Like, let's talk whitewater rescue specifically.
Yeah. So if we talk whitewater rescue specifically, I mean, I think it depends what kind of course you're taking. So we talked about three different levels. Sometimes it's two. It depends on which organization you work with. But I feel like we see now throughout the new era of technology and stuff, like we have in Quebec some provincial program with the Consortium de Sécurité en Rivière du Québec. It's another organization I work with. And
I can't pronounce any of that. Those are, that's French, right?
Yeah, that's French, bro. Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So with these guys, what we did is there's a online modules that you have to take prior to your field course. So there's a lot of prevention and learning that goes through this, and it's kind of a online book, you know, I'd say it like that, and you can always come back to it. There's some pictures, there's some reading, there's some videos, and this I think helps a big part of the prevention side of thing, that you have access before your course. So it, people are coming in and they have questions, you know, which is really good, because you'll start your course the first morning and you'll start answering those questions. You'll start talking prevention with these guys. And one thing that I like to do as a rescue instructor is every time I get to the site we're going to use for the morning or for the day, then we always have that safety briefing of who's doing what if something happens. Where are the exit points? What are the risks we're seeing on the river right here, right now? What are the potential scenarios that could happen? Stuff like that. So we build from the moment they are in their chair at their place, reading that online modules. Then they come with questions. Then we answer those questions. Then we get on the river and we talk more before we get to the action. So I feel that there's a big part of prevention, but it's not about watch out, guys. The river can be fast and the flow of the river can put you downstream. You know, with river guides, people, they know, they use the river. They have that river sense, you know, the way they act on the side of the river is already a little bit towards safety and prevention. They don't walk onto the side of the river without their helmet and their life jacket clipped on. Well, most of the time, like, especially if you're into a recertification class or if your journey has been started from a long time, you know. But if you're a first year river guide and it's you really get your introduction to that world, then for sure we're going to spend more time talking about it and answering those questions and trying to build on the top of that.
Cool. So are you saying, like, in a class you're teaching, that a lot of the prevention is done through online modules ahead of time, and the in-person time is mostly spent on rescue?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I love that. I feel like there's a place, like, we're in a world where having an online part to classes is really beneficial. I just did a woofer research and I really appreciated that a lot of the stuff was online, because I could do it at my own pace, think about it, absorb it over time. And if I wanted to do more research on something, I could. So if a lot of the medical stuff that, instead of being lectured, you know, 8 hours straight, I did like one of these a day. And if I was curious about strokes, I would just go do a little bit of research on my own and then come back. So I like learned over time. And same thing with rescue. If we had more online stuff ahead of time, like, you know, do your knots. Here's some stuff about preventing hypothermia. Here's some stuff about dressing appropriately. Here's some other prevention stuff. I think that's a great way we could be doing classes better. Because we're not in the US, I mean, we don't have that. That's something that makes me think that we should have is just an online component like that.
Yeah, and I feel like the online component helps with heaps of stuff. Like for some people that I've never touched rope or never did any nuts, it's kind of hard to tell them like, yeah, hey, this, I show you this nut, I help you make it. And then at the end of the day, you need to redo it, but you did it once or twice, you know? So sometimes it's a little bit hard. If I get to the online module or I send some emails before and I tell them, hey, practice this. Hey, go online on this app or on this website and you'll see how you can do this nut and practice before, you know? So there's also not necessarily prevention, but also just maybe something I can send you before so you can start practicing. And some people won't like do it, but if one or two people did it, then this is going to help everyone else and I can focus on some other stuff, you know, with other person, or I can help them more. And that's definitely like, I think there's a big side of preparation before the classes that are going to help the students and the instructor while you are on the field and you have to like get all of that action going.
Yeah, I mean, spending 2 hours on knots is time that's wasted. It could be done doing way more stuff. My friend Santi, who teaches rescue in Ecuador, sends out videos on the 6 knots he requires or whatever. You have to show up for the class, being able to tie all 6. If you can't tie the 6 knots, he tests you right away. If you can't, you're just not even in the course, which I'm not sure if that would fly in the US. Like people would get angry, but in Ecuador, he's just like, no, go home. Like, I'm not going to accept you because you didn't learn the knots.
Yeah. Well, I feel like maybe, I don't know if in Canada it would work or not.
People will get grumpy.
Yeah.
Like
if they showed up for sure.
And failed something or like you go home. Like you don't get to go. Some countries, some cultures, that's okay. I know in our culture, like that would be, people would be upset. They would do a negative review for sure.
And talk
bad about you.
Yeah. And I feel like my job as an instructor is also to help you learn how to do this nut, you know? So I cannot just say, hey, do it on your own. And if you can't learn it, then you're not in my class.
That's an interesting one.
Yeah.
Let's keep moving. We got lots of questions. This one should be quick. CPR for drowning, which is different than CPR that you learn in a CPR class. Where should you learn that? Where should that be taught?
In every rescue class, I guess. I mean, it doesn't take much time. And I'm not a... wilderness or medicine expert or trainer, not at all. But I feel like some of the CPR stuff are really easy to learn and to teach. And that is part of prevention as well. So it should be somewhere in those classes. If you work on a professional level, at some point, you're going to be required to have that first aid certificate. So you should learn it through there. But I'm talking more about the recreative paddlers. Like these guys, they might not have a first aid certificate. So I feel like it's a really good thing to teach it through a rescue class because it's one of the main, if not the main danger on the river is drowning, you know? So knowing how to do it. And I feel like it would be really hard to like mess it up. You know, like if you try... If like someone is drowning, someone is unresponsive, someone's not breathing, trying your best to get that person to breathe won't, in my head, won't do more damage than to do nothing.
Yeah, it's true.
So,
I've been really afraid to teach CPR because I'm not a CPR instructor. I'm not. But lately, I asked a person who owns a wilderness first responder company who teaches this stuff, like, how should I feel about teaching it? She's like, you should teach it. Like, people need to know this. Do the best you can to teach it. Keep refreshing your information. So we've been teaching it more and more in a lot of our classes because it's so important.
Yeah. But,
and you're saying rescue classes, it should be an important topic of rescue classes.
Yeah, definitely. And like the way I feel that all the organization I work with always have a first aid side of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's talking about it like hypothermia, drowning, secondary drowning, maybe breaking a leg because you've been entrapped, stuff like that. Like there's a basic around it. So we do talk about it, but I feel a little bit the same as you. I mean, I'm not a first aid instructor. I'm not necessarily qualified on paper to do it. So I'm always a little bit, I don't know, you know, but sometimes people, they will have the knowledge and we're going to do it as an open discussion. You know, I feel that just talking about it is a really, really great thing. And a first step into getting into that, maybe people are going to do more research. Maybe someone has medical background in your class and you can talk about it. But for us in Quebec, I feel that one of the problem is the insurance. So we're really, really big on insurance, probably one of the place in the world where you have too much insurance. And this kind of blocks us for a lot of things. Like if you're not certified on paper for that, you cannot teach that, you know, that's how it's going to work. So you have to do that due diligence. And so it's a little bit of a loophole. And I think it's also the great moment to say that what I'm saying in this podcast with you might not reflect everything or every organization I work with. I really talk on behalf of myself, you know? But yeah, I feel like this is one of the main, if not the main thing that can happen on the river, and doing nothing would be worse than try your best.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to knots. And I feel like there's like a basic set of knots that gets you through most things. And there's like all the knots. When you're teaching a typical rescue class for guides, what knots do you teach? What do you think are the important knots? If it's somebody's first rescue class, what knots do you think they need to know?
Ooh, good questions. That can be a rabbit hole for sure. In a classic, like, once again, you have that introductionary level. Let's talk intermediate, because this is the course that everybody kind of does, and it's the middle ground. I'd say figure eight on a bite, figure eight follow through, papillon, what's butterfly?
Okay, alpine butterfly. What do you call
alpine
it?
Alpine butterfly. Papillon, it's the French term. Yeah, so alpine butterfly. Sometimes the fisherman, double fisherman, but you can do the same thing with the figure eight follow through. So it depends which cool you're coming from. And I also have in French, we call it the plein point. And it's just when you bring two ropes together and you do a single knot. It's kind of the canyoning knot when I want to tie two ropes together.
Oh, yeah. The European death knot.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. The European death knot. So that I'll teach also. I'm trying to think if I forget one.
Do you say water knot?
Oh, yeah. Water knot for the webbing. 100%. Yep. Yeah. That's an important one. I'm trying to think about it.
Figure eight follow through.
Yeah.
Figure eight on a bite. They're all the same thing, basically.
Yeah.
Water knot, alpine butterfly, maybe European double fishermen's, and European death knot.
Yeah. Prussic loop as well, if you count it as a knot.
Yeah. Prussic, like attaching a prussic to a rope.
Yeah. Attaching the prussic to the rope. Cool. Yeah.
Sweet. All right. Because I know some rescue instructors that teach twice that number of knots. And so I'm just trying to get a sense of what people are teaching and which knots they value. Mark and I talked about this recently. You need to be able to attach a rope to something and you need to be able to make a loop.
Yeah.
With those two things, you can do almost everything. If you can just attach a rope to something and make a big loop, that's a huge amount. And you can do a figure eight on a bite with a carabiner. It can attach to stuff.
Yeah.
And a big loop allows you to do all your anchors.
Yeah. If I go a little bit deeper, I'll teach some like Munter hitch and Italian hitch. Is it the same in English? Munter hitch, Italian hitch?
Same knot. Yeah, same knot.
Yeah. So there's the half hitch then. I don't know the English term for it.
There's like two half hitches and tautline hitch in that family.
Yeah. So, well, these I'll use when I get to a little bit of a hopper level. So if I want to lower a boat down the cliff, or if I want to tie up a rope and bring some slack in when I do some mechanical advantage, then I'll show that. And sometimes if you get to that more advanced level and you get to, you start to use a little bit of like rope and belaying system and stuff like that for like more technical creaking, or then we're going to take a little bit more nuts, but then we're going to be in a whole new spectrum, because we're not going to use only whitewater rescue equipment. We're going to use climbing equipment. So yeah, there's some other notion, but yeah.
Okay, let's say this is my theoretical. There's a boat wrapped and you only have one mechanical vantage system. I know that when a boat wraps, you do all the things. You jump up and down, you push and pull. I know you do all the things, but let's just say there's a world where you only get to pick one mechanical vantage system. Which one do you pick to pull on it?
I think I'm going to... Oh, that's a good question. I'm a big fan of the pig rig 4-to-1. To be honest, I really like this system. But if I had only one to choose, maybe just a simple 3-to-1.
Why do you like the pig rig?
I like the fact that you have two lines. It takes a little bit more equipment, but yeah, like if I can attach a line to my boat and the boat gets out, then I'll still have it somewhere, you know, and I won't have to play with all of my carabiners and pulleys and prusik into that line. So just the fact that the system is external for me is a big advantage. And I come more from a rafting background, and we always carry a ready to go 4-to-1, like a ready to go pig rig that I can just put on the line that I've put on the raft. So I just feel like it saves time, and it takes the same amount of equipment, just one more rope, which if you don't paddle by yourself, should be good, you know?
Yeah. So you attach the boat.
So there's a line, a tree, there's an anchor.
Like there's a line that goes from the boat to like the boat to a tree. Yeah. And then you run the pig rig on that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. But you said if you only pick one, you probably would go 3-to-1.
Yeah.
You only probably have one. Because it's so universal, versatile. Everybody knows it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, this is the next one. I think we probably talked about last fall. How do you feel about teaching strainer swims and rescue courses? This is my pet peeve right now.
Yeah, I love it. If we're talking whitewater rescue, well, I'll teach it in boat classes, so whitewater rescue and swiftwater rescue, just not with the same emphasis. Okay. When I teach it, I start from the conclusion, like the end of the lesson, and I go back to the beginning. So the main thing for me is I want people to remember that if there's a strainer in the river, you want to swim away from it. So that's the main goal of the exercise. Now, if I'm with whitewater rescue people, boaters, paddlers, these guys, they already have a knowledge of the flow. They kind of know how powerful it can be. They have that river sense a little bit more than swiftwater rescue clientele. So how I'll start my drill most of the time and is going to be, there's this trainer there. You're going to swim towards it. I give a whistle and I want you to swim away from it, you know? So getting that in their mind. Then after that, what I'll do is I want you to go and get stuck on it so you can feel the water pressure, you know? And I want you to try and go over it. And then after that, it's going to be something like, hey, try to put your feet on it, move away from it. Or last thing, hey, there's also this. You can try and go over it. When I do it, I'll use a thwart from a raft and I'll put water into it like halfway through. So it kind of sinks a little bit and it looks more like a log, you know, because the classic thing we see is the PVC pipe going on the top of the water and going like do, do, do. And it's like super dangerous. So by doing it with the thwart, sinks in a little bit more, a little bit bulkier. But what I want people to remember is really that they want to swim away from it. Now, if I'm with a swift water rescue team, then these guys, they might not have the same river sense. They're not using day by day the river. They need to know that this thing is really powerful and it's dangerous. So most of the time with them, I'll start by go on the log, jam yourself on it, you know? And then when you don't like it, or like a few seconds, then you go under it, you know, not when you don't like it. I'm not trying to scare people off. Yeah. So, because what I want them to remember is, whoa, this is really powerful and I don't want to be in that situation. And then after that, we'll start the drill of swimming away from it. So I might spend a little bit more time. I think it's a good thing if the outcome is, whoa, this thing is dangerous, I want to get away from it, especially because it's really hard to recreate a tree with branches sticking everywhere. And yeah, like, you want to make it safe. So you need something kind of slick. PVC pipe is good. I think where the main thing, and we were talking about it in September, is you don't want to use 2 hours of your class to do that. Like if it takes you 2 hours to set up the thing, do the drill, it might be a little bit too long. You could have spent more time doing something else, you know? And after that, what I can say is, if you do it in somewhere where the flow is super, super slow, what's the point? So you have to find that in between, and it's not every site that can provide that. So sometimes it's really hard to set. So if I'm in a site where it doesn't really provide, then I might just go for a slower pace of flow. It's kind of in between, but I'm trying to have it every time. You can also show videos to people. You can show people the power of the river differently as well. Sometimes, like just on the rock and try to like body wrap yourself, you know, like, so for me, the main outcome of this is what I want you to learn is that you don't want to be in this situation and swim away from it. Yeah. That's the main goal for me.
I like that you have a learning outcome, because I feel a lot of people that teach strainer swims, there's no learning outcome. Like, we're just going to swim strainers, but like, the learning outcome is swim away from wood, avoid it. You want to avoid wood. And if you're in the water above it, swim away. I love that. That's your you have an outcome and a plan.
Yeah, and because
I feel like people say, we're going to do strainer swim, and they do it. And then they don't have an outcome. They're just like teaching people how powerful the river is or something.
Yeah. And I feel like strainer swim are also a good moment to introduce like the clean principle. I know that's a big topic and we might talk about it later on, but like, you're in a safe environment with a PVC pipe, super slick, and like, imagine if your cowtail or something gets cut in it.
Yeah,
like imagine if you're in a tree. So that's like, you have a lot of secondary learning outcomes as well in those kind of activity. But yeah, I feel like it's a valuable thing, because that scenario can happen. And if you are in an environment where there's heaps of log, like every time falling into your river, that this is one of the main danger, then clearly we're going to talk about it and spend the time to understand that danger. If you're in a river where there's no log, it's only rocks, it's big water.
Like the Grand Canyon.
Like the Grand Canyon, like, for sure, I'll talk to you about it, but the way my lesson is planned might be through videos, to talking, to questioning people, more than to, let's try to set up a log in the Grand, like on the Colorado. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Cool. Let's keep moving. What do you think training for now? The audience here, who I care about talking to, are whitewater paddlers. We're not talking to firefighters here. They're hopefully not watching this show. They should watch some other better show. We're talking about whitewater paddlers. What do you think training for foot entrapment rescue should look like for whitewater boaters?
So there's a lot of different technique out there, and there, I think that the foot entrapment is definitely one of the like gnarliest scenario you can have on the river, because it happens fast. It's, and you like, it's a time sensitive issue. What I mean by that is if you get your ankle stuck and you're in super shallow water and you can put your arms down and you can breathe, then fine. Like, we're not that much into a time sensitive issue for now. If you get your knee stuck or your ankle or whatever, and you get your head into the water, then we're definitely into a time sensitive issue. Like, you need to act fast. So you need people to be able to use the different techniques or the different tools in their toolbox fast. For me, when I teach it, is more the way I introduce it is, here is the problem we can face, and these are the different techniques you can use to rescue someone. I used to teach it the same for the past years, where it was like, you have someone that you can reach, you can walk, you can swim to that person and make a direct contact. Nice. This is, for me, the best way to do it. If you can be there, you give that physical support and that emotional support also, because I can see the person, look in the eyes, talk to that person, be there in front. So that's really good. After that, it's not every river where you can do that. Sometimes you have only one bank access, so you'll need to use a technique as kind of a U cinch, a cinch line over that person. Sometimes you do it by yourself. Sometimes you do it with two person. Sometimes you do it with two person with two throw bags. So all of these different techniques are going to be regarding the environment you are in. And there's also the techniques with two bank access, which I feel works good in a creek or when it's not that large, but most of our river in Quebec are kind of large. So I'm always a little bit hesitant with that technique, where I'm like, if I need to use that, then it means all of the other tools that I have that I feel personally are better haven't worked, you know? And so this technique with two riverbank, most of the time when I teach it, I'll teach it on the ground. People are just going to try and manipulate the rope, start it, practice on land. And then we're going to do it in a scenario where everybody has kind of a role. But the first three, where you go direct contact, you go cinch by yourself, cinch two person, these we're going to practice on the river, just drills. Cool. Like, do it once, do it twice, do it a third time. Because I want you to know how to manipulate your rope. I want you to be dialed in on these. And then I'll show them on land the two bank technique, and that I'll put in a scenario, because everybody can be in that scenario. It takes a lot of person, lots of gear, lots of everything, you know, so I don't want to take too much time on that. And my learning outcome out of it most of the time is, if you can make direct contact, this is the best thing, you know. And I really talk about whitewater boater. Sometimes when I want to integrate more scenarios, then maybe I'll go someone walking on a tether to go help that person, someone swimming on a tether. And I didn't use it that much, like the tether in those scenario, but I'm still in New Zealand, but at the beginning of the season, I had to pass my guide license, and they have a part of the exam that is on rescue. And there's the perfect spot for a foot entrapment, just above like 1.5 meter drop with a recirculative hole. And they're like, there's someone stuck right there, foot entrap. What do you do? And I'm like, all right. You know, I was like, okay, I'll use a cinch by myself if I can, first thing, because it's not super far. But I was like, reaching that person would really be the best. But I don't want to swim what's down there, you know? Yeah. So I was like, if I have someone with me, then I'll go tethered, you know, because I don't want to swim the drop. Or I don't want my subject or the person to swim the drop if my cinch fell or stuff like that, you know? So So yeah, that's most of the time how I teach it. But I dream of a world where we could do scenarios with people in boats and being like, you go down the river, someone flips, pulls the skirt and gets stuck. And then there's only one boater in the back that kind of needs to hack fast. Like we had an entrapment on the river I work on, not with my company, but another company a couple of years ago. And what happened is the person was doing some sledging down the river and had some palms on their feet. And it's not the ankle, but the palm that got cut. And the safety kayak from the trip just pulled his skirt out, swam to the person and grabbed her and turned her and like has been able to take out the palm. So that kind of got really quick thinking, but that person had heaps of experience, was a rescuer, a good safety boater, stuff like that. So I'd like to integrate more of that, you know, also in kind of like the real thing. Sometimes I put a dummy in the water that I attach by the leg and it's just like, okay, swim to it, reach, make direct contact. Because if the person is underwater, then won't be able to put the line under their shoulder, you know? So yeah.
I like that.
I hope that answers.
Yeah. I think that, you know, we teach waiting. But waiting, like if you had like four people waiting, it just takes too long because they're just one step at a time. They're a team. But I think teaching before this, like move, what I've heard Mark refer to is moving in a whitewater environment, like just walking around from rock to rock, being thoughtful about where your feet are, pointing your feet upstream, maybe swimming across, like being able to get to somebody by yourself quickly is a really useful skill. Not just to get a pinned person, but if a boat's just stuck, an extra hand out there to be like, hey, I would need to help you out. So I think I like the idea where you teach moving around in a whitewater environment, do like shallow water by yourself, and then moving into how can I use that to help with entrapments.
And
I was teaching a rescue class at Mark last year, and we taught them shallow water techniques. I mean, a person pinned on the rock, and they couldn't figure out how to get to them. Mark would be like, use the shallow water techniques. And then five of them walked out. It took them forever. And finally, Mark was like, no. And he demonstrated it. He just ran out there and got him. You know, like just go get the person. Get hands on him if you can. If you're able to move around in that water, don't think about like all these complicated techniques that you learn in the class.
Yeah. So
I like that you say you start with like get hands on him. I think that's really smart.
Yeah. And I like the fact that you said like, oh, sometimes we teach to wait. Like what I feel about waiting is it's definitely a super good thing. Like, yes, but the time you're going to take to wait is different from every individual. For me, it might take me half a second. It might take me 1 second. As for someone that has less experience or less judgment, might take a little bit more. And there's heaps of things that comes into consideration. Am I on the river I super well know? Am I with friends that I know are good rescuers and stuff like that? Like, so in the back of my mind, those things unconsciously happens, you know, because I can base it on my experience and my judgment. So I know I can go, like Jim says, you know I can go, I know I should go. So those answers in my head can take 2 seconds to answer, but those questions in my head can take 2 seconds to answer. But for someone else who has less experience or less judgment, then the waiting part might be a super good thing. If you take 10 seconds, it's just like, wait, whoa, I don't really know this spot. Oh, okay. I see the rock that I can walk there. Okay. Oh, that's how that person is entrapped, or, you know, so it's a really good thing to wait, but I feel like it's the waiting time is going to be different from one person to another. And if waiting for you means being like that on the side of the river for 2 minutes, then for an entrapment scenario, it's going to be too late. You know,
are you saying waiting like wait, or waiting like WADE waiting? Oh, like waiting out. Are you saying wait, like spend time on the shore, or waiting like walk by yourself in shallow water?
Oh, no, I was thinking wait, like spend time on the bank, you know, just stop. Like, stop is like a stop, think, observe, plan. That's what I meant by that. It's like you can do those steps super fast in your head and get to the person, you know, or you can take a little bit more time, analyze, and then go.
Cool. All right, let's keep plugging away. Two more questions, then we got to finish this up soon. The next is, what's your favorite PFD right now? What are you wearing as a PFD? And do you have preferences about color or flotation, anything else?
My favorite one is the Palm Nevis right now. I've tried heaps of different life jacket throughout the years. There's a lot of them that I like. Like, to me, the top life jacket is the Astral Green Jacket, is a really good PFD. The Stolquist Descent was a really good one too. And the Palm Nevis, I really like. There's also one from Peak UK. I don't remember the name of it, that I really like. But my favorite for the use, my use, is the Palm Nevis. There's heaps of space in it. I like the flotation. It's comfortable. And there's that like adjustment for the quick release harness. You don't have to tread it. And it's really like, like a two-step thing. I really like that. And I feel that all the new life jacket will have that. So you won't have to cut your tail. But yeah, Palm Nevis is for me the way to go. Really.
Cool. And do you have a preference on color or flotation? Do you have any thoughts about?
I like the red one just because where I work, all the boats are red. So, but yeah, I feel a visible color is the best depending on the environment you are in. Like if you can get seen, is really, really good. And what I like about the Palm Nevis is that there's those huge reflective strap on shoulders that I really like for like kind of darkish moment, night ops and stuff like that. It really helps.
All right. Last question. How do you feel about training people on doing, we talked about this earlier, doing training with rescue tethers? Like, how valuable do you think that is for whitewater paddlers?
I think it's a really good skills to have for sure. The way I used to teach it most of the time, just because it was a time sensitive issue in the curriculum, was we have someone floating down the river, jump in, go get that person. Now, for me, this scenario is maybe one in, I don't know how many chances, you know? So this is not the kind of thing you're going to see in your day to day. Well, I hope not, to be honest. But there was heaps of secondary learning outcomes out of that. Like I said, how you place yourself as a belayer, how you handle your rope, just doing a knot on your rope and clip it to someone, you know, how to tread your quick release harness, which is a little bit, has been controversial, and not all the manufacturers design good tail length and stuff, you know? So yeah, those secondary objectives, that's how I used to teach it most of the time. And I still do, you know, like that. But the way I see the tether rescue, the best way I like to teach it is when there's someone in a hole or a boat in a hole and I need to get to that. And I once again, I come back to the example where I was tethered to go get someone that is entrapped. I feel that tethering someone is, you just put a set on brains at the end of the rope, which is a really good thing. And for us, where I work, we also use it. There are some scenarios where you would need to do it quickly. Some retentive holes where boat can get stuck. Customers can swim in them. Thankfully, it doesn't happen very much. But that is the way I see it. It's like, if you have to run a bigger rapid, and there's a retentive hole, why not put someone on the side already set up with the tethered, someone that's belaying, someone with a boat downstream for extra safety, and the person that is on the tether can also have a throw bag in their hand, you know? Just throw the bag, didn't work, bring the bag super quick, jump in the water, or you see that the bag's not going to work, leave the bag aside, jump on the water. Those are all the possible scenarios, you know? So I feel it's a really good skills to have. It's just, you need to teach it properly because it can be kind of on the more complex side of the balance, the scale. So yeah, you just have to be careful with it. Like, it's not the goal for people to do always tethered rescue. Like you're in the class and it's like, oh, okay, I have this scenario. Oh, I'll tether myself and I'll swim to that person. And you're like, yeah, we've been swimming here since the first day. You know the environment. Like you could just throw a bag, you could just swim by yourself. Like you've done this swim twice, maybe 50 times, you know? And now you want to tether yourself to go get that person that is responsive. Why? You know, so I feel it's a really great skills to teach. And it's a, like, if you're a river professional, you need to wear a PFD with a quick release harness. You need to know how to do that technique and properly. But I don't think it's the solution to everything.
Do you guys use, on the rivers you work, do you use them at all? I vaguely remember you telling me there was like rapid where you use them every time.
Yeah, no, we don't use it every time. There's a spot where we always have safety with a throw bag. Mm-hmm. And if someone end up in this part of the rapid when the water is higher, then one of the solution we're going to use is this. You can clip yourself, jump, go get the boat, extract it, you know, and hopefully nobody's is under the boat getting recirced. But most of the time, I can access as a safety kayak on the rock, then leave my kayak on the rock, jump on the boat, paddle the boat out, like classic raft guide style, you know, but it's not always like that. We've had moments where you need to take the boat out, you know, because, or sometimes I'll just throw a rope because the guide is still on the boat and he's the only one. Like there's stuff like that, but there's three major spots where we could definitely need to go and do that, you know. Yeah. So
in Quebec or New Zealand?
In Quebec. Yeah. No, here in New Zealand is where I work right now. No, you shouldn't need that.
Yeah. So like if let's say where you work now in New Zealand, you shouldn't need that. Do you feel like guides should still wear that rescue PFD, have that harness in their PFD? Do you think it's still important for them?
Yeah, I feel for me, well, it's a tough question because if your goal is to be a river guide on a specific river and that's the only thing you do in your life, maybe not, you know, like maybe not. But if you take a class or if you're a guide that goes on multiple river and you want to consider yourself as a river guide and not a specific river guide, then yes, I definitely think you need to learn all of those techniques. If you paddle from time to time by yourself with your friends, doing other missions, they might need you to do that technique, you know? And if I'm the one that knows it and I need to clip myself and jump, I want to make sure that you know how to handle the rope at the end, you know? So I feel that if you are a river guide that goes internationally or nationally and you go on different rivers or on the river you work on needs that, then yes, definitely. If your goal is just to be a specific river guide at your only spot and you don't have any more, as like you don't want to do anything else, maybe not.
We kind of mentioned this earlier, right? We had to talk about like beginner, intermediate, advanced course, like different levels of courses. I've kind of been thinking about this. In the beginning, like an introductory rescue class, like a class for a first or second year guide or a private boater, maybe talk about how to release them, but don't actually use them in the river. Just say, here's how they work. Here's how you thread them. Here's how you release them. Practice on shore. And then maybe in the more intermediate or advanced class, that's when you would practice with them in the water. Or do you feel like from the beginning, people should practice with them in the water? If you're going to have it on, you should practice with it in the water.
Yeah, I feel that if you have it, you should know how it works. Mm-hmm. Definitely. But depending on the, like in an introductionary level, I wouldn't even talk about it. But if people in my class have life jacket with it, then I'll take the time to talk about it. And maybe outside of the curriculum at night, I'll do a quick session on how to use it, how to be safe with it, stuff like that. But I feel that you can start your journey into whitewater by having a PFD that doesn't have a quick release harness, and you can learn to swim, to throw a bag, to do different techniques. But you might be in an environment that doesn't require it, you know? And at some point, you're going to go further into your journey and you'll need that piece of equipment for the environment you are in. So yeah, that's how I see it. In introductionary level, I wouldn't necessarily use it because people could come in my class with a life jacket that doesn't have one, because the introductionary level to me is not what you need to be working in the industry. Yeah. Then you get to the intermediate level, and then we're going to show you all the specific details of how you tread it, how you use it, how you take it out in the water. Because if you've never done that before, the moment you tie yourself on and you need to release won't be a super nice moment, you know? And even if you've practiced EAPS, it might not be a super nice moment. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we did it. We made it through all the questions. Thank you for answering them. Thanks for the great conversation, for being in New Zealand right now and showing up to do this. I really appreciate it. And I hope our paths cross soon. I'm not sure when or how or why, but like, I hope I'll see you somewhere else. Maybe this summer. I don't see myself going to Quebec, but it's really nice to see you on the screen right now. So thanks for being here.
Right. Thanks to you, Zach, for having me on the show. It's always cool to talk about this different things. And if I think that Gear Garage provides that platform for people to learn more, to debate, to get their ideas out. And this is what's going to help the community grow. So I really feel super happy to be part of it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Maybe we're going to see each other in the fall at some point, maybe IRF symposium or something. That would be nice.
That's right. We're going to do it on the Gauley in West Virginia.
Yeah, there you go.
Be a symposium. I'll see you there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sweet. Well, thanks. Stay on real quick. I'm going to shut this down and we can chat for a minute when I'm done.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, man.